Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Morning. We're delighted to welcome you all to our second day into our October sitting. And we want to especially welcome some students who are here. We have from MATC paralegal students. Would they please stand so we can recognize them? I'm on the wrong day. It was yesterday. Got it. All right, we'll start again. I'm very happy to welcome you all here today. Our second day of oral argument, and we are happy to welcome some students. We have students from Craig High School. Are they here? Would you please stand? Oh, wow. And welcome to you all. Thank you. You may be seated. And we have students from Platteville High School. Would they please stand? Good, and thank you all for coming, and your instructors also. The students are here with a national prize-winning program called Court with Class. This program is sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. High school students are welcome here and invited to come to an oral argument, and if the invitation is accepted, they get the briefs of the case we are about to hear and may engage in some activities relating to the case. The students then come, listen to oral argument, and we'll meet with a justice after the second oral argument. The discussion will be about the procedures the court uses to hear cases and decide them, not about the substantive issues. Everyone is welcome to those conversations. They are not limited to the students. Now, we have summaries of, as soon as the marshal gets back, we have summaries of the case we're about to hear. And it's better to listen to oral argument if you know something about the case. So, when she comes back, if you want a summary, raise your hand, and she will distribute summaries to you all. Let me introduce the court. Ah, there you are. Does anyone want a summary of the case? Please raise your hand.
Wow. That's one of those things. Yeah.
Lawyers cannot have the summary. We may have to get some more summaries, but anyhow, let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far left is our newest justice, Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Patience Rogensack. Justice Rogensack will meet with you all after the second case. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her right is Justice David Prosser, and on the far right is Justice Lewis Butler. Now, does everyone have a summary who needs one? If not, we'll get some more, and you will have them. So let me call the first case, 05AP2796, Michelle Richards versus Badger Mutual Insurance. And let me talk about first the time allotments for the speakers so we make sure we're all on the same page here. The plaintiffs, Michelle Richards, will be represented and for 25 minutes by Keith Satchewak. Badger Mutual, Eric Darling for 20 minutes. 5 minutes, Ralph Weber, representing the Amicus Civil Trial Council of Wisconsin. 5 minutes, James Freeman, representing the Amicus Wisconsin Insurance Alliance of Property Casualty Insurers Association of America, and then 5 minutes in rebuttal for the representative of the plaintiffs. Everybody is nodding, so I'm assuming that is correct. So, counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Keith Stachowiak. I represent the plaintiff and the petitioner in this court, Michelle Richards. There's no dispute about the legal issue involved here, which is, does Wisconsin Statute 895.045 sub 2, which imposes joint and several liability on individuals that act in accordance with a common scheme or plan, apply to a group of individuals who planned and carried out a plan to illegally purchase beer for an underage person when that person became drunk, got behind the wheel of a motor vehicle, and killed an innocent third party? Under the Court of Appeals' interpretation of this statute, we have a completely faultless plaintiff being forced to bear a portion of the loss rather than an admittedly negligent tortfeasor. What was the prior law? If this happened in 1994, there'd be no question but Shrimp and Pratchett and Zimmerle were jointly and severally liable. What does joint and several liability mean? It means that each defendant is individually responsible for the entire damages. Individually responsible for the entire damages. In 1995, the legislature limited joint and several liability except in one instance, and that instance is where the parties are involved in a common scheme or plan. If they're involved in a common scheme or plan, the default common law rule of joint and several liability applies. What is a common scheme or plan? It's not defined in the statutes. You're not going to find those words in the case law, but it's not a legal or a technical term. Those words have a commonly understood meaning. In this case, we have three individuals.
Counsel, let me pause you right there. Common meaning. When I read the statute, and I understand from your brief that you're arguing that Section 895.045 sub 2 is unambiguous.
That's right.
And when I read the words of the statute that are at issue here, it talks in terms of two or more parties act in accordance with a common scheme or plan. Those parties are jointly and severally liable for all damages resulting from that action. I pause because when I read the language with a common scheme or plan, my reaction is common scheme or plan to do what?
It would be to carry out some activity that could be found negligent. Because in the first instance, before you'd even get to this statute, the parties have to be held liable. There has to be a finding by the jury of negligence and cause. And it's that negligence and cause that has to be the subject of the common scheme or plan.
And the reason I ask the question is, depending upon whether this court agrees or disagrees with that interpretation, when I look at the plain language of the statute, the plain language of the statute doesn't say that. It talks in terms of common scheme or plan, but I find myself left hanging. Is it a common scheme or plan to do what? And to give an example, if we take the same fact situation here and modify it a bit and say that the parties had agreed to get together that morning to drive, and they're going to wake up at a particular time, they're going to call each other, and they're going to drive up to go watch the Packer Bear game. All right. Now you have a common scheme or plan to go watch the Bear game. If they hadn't gotten up that morning, there would have been no accident. No one would have been hurt. And yet I don't think anybody in their right mind would sit here and argue that that would fall within the confines of the statute. So right. There's something that seems to be missing there.
I think what's missing, first of all, is there needs to be a finding of negligence on those parties. So the activity that they're engaged in has to be a tortious activity. as it was in this case, but it wouldn't be necessarily in your example.
Which raises the question, then, does it have to be a common scheme or plan to commit a tortious activity? Does it have to be a common scheme or plan to commit an act that could in and of itself is negligence per se? An act, does it have to be all of the negligence? That's what I'm trying to get at. What do you have an agreement to kick in sub 2?
Sure. I think under these facts, under our facts, it doesn't really matter because they were engaging in a tortious activity. Now, the statute itself does not require the parties, the common scheme or plan, to accomplish a result or to accomplish a tortious purpose. That's not in the statute. That's the restatement approach of the concerted action theory of liability. But that is not in our statute. The legislature didn't choose those words. But I would maintain that, I mean, before you even get to those questions on joint and several, there has to be some liability on each of these parties. And if you have that liability, the question that would naturally flow would be, is the common scheme or plan, does it involve those activities for which that individual is found negligent?
Counsel, how significant is it that you have a stipulation here, and the stipulation assigns responsibility or negligence, if I remember right, 72%, 14%, and 14%? My understanding is the Court of Appeals found that very significant and said that what's really anticipated by this statute is equal responsibility, and yet your stipulation runs counter to that. How do you respond to the Court of Appeals majority approach?
There's no language in the statute that requires equal liability, and it's interesting that the legislature used the term joint and several liability. Now, what's the definition of joint and several liability? It means liable for all the damages, liable for all the damages. It doesn't say equal liability. And I think if you interpret that to include equal liability, if you interpret that into the statute, those words, joint and several liability, are redundant. They're meaningless.
Well, doesn't that tie into the idea of concerted action? Isn't concerted action under our case law usually tied to this idea of equal responsibility?
No, not necessarily. If you go back to the early joint and several cases, and I believe it was Your Honor that wrote the opinion in Matthews versus Positive Safety, about 6 years ago, you went through the common law development of joint and several liability. And I'm sort of paraphrasing now, but you said there were two categories. The original joint and several involved the joint torts, where people were working together. Later joint and several developed to cases where independent acts of negligence concurred in time to produce an indivisible injury. Those are the two categories. Now, when you talked about that first category, the language that was used was they participated in a concert of action, a concert of action. That's how joint and several developed. So I guess to answer your question, I think the legislature, by subsection 1 of this, meant to change the law as it concerned concurrent but independent acts of negligence. But sub 2 left intact the common law when parties were acting together, and the legislature chose the terms acting in accordance with a common scheme and plan. Now, that pretty much summarizes what those earlier cases are that started the whole joint and several liability doctrine.
Let me just pick up on that. You've got two independent negligent acts here, as I see it. One is driving, right?
Right.
And the only one that can be liable for that independent act is Zimmerle. He was the driver.
Right.
There's no showing here that the other two defendants had anything to do with the driving.
Right.
The second independent negligent act is the acquisition of the intoxicating beverage by and for underaged persons, right?
Right.
And there, the underage person, what was their name? Shrimp. 14% liability.
Right.
That's what he's liable for, right? And the other person in that second independent act was the purchaser of the product, Pratchett, right?
Right.
Equal liability, 14%.
14%.
Now, here's the deal. The driver is 72% negligent, according to the stipulation. But that 72% negligent is really two negligences, right?
Two separate acts, yes.
Two separate acts. One is driving, and the other is the acquisition. Now, one should assume that in that 72%, that 14% of it is
procurement.
Is the procurement of the alcohol, right?
Right.
Because that's what the two other people got, and why should he be any different? So you could divide the 72% into, I think it's 58, is it? And 14, right?
Right.
When you divide it that way and you look at the case that way, you've got equal negligence.
Never thought of that, Your Honor.
I know.
And neither has anybody else, and we've spent many, many hours.
I know. But, I mean, that is the division here. And so you have three people here who, in concert, acted, each 14% negligent under the stipulation. I mean, it has to be to make any sense. And what you have, which is what, using your words, is two independent negligent acts resulting in one indivisible injury.
Yes.
So what's the matter with my theory? And I'm going to ask your opposing counsels the same, because it seems to me that when you divide it up that way, you do have all the definitions of that the Court of Appeals majority opinion wanted you to have. You fit.
And they would be
I think you should run with that case and just reinterpret the facts.
And they would be responsible then for all damages that resulted.
Well, you can't divide the damages. I mean, you can't say that the death was caused X percent by the procurement of alcohol and Y percent by running a red light at great speed. I mean, that is your definition.
Right, right.
Don't buy it totally.
I haven't thought that through yet, but it's very intriguing, very intriguing.
Because it just does fit here. Now, of course, your interest might be much broader, not only your case, but in future cases that might not come out that way.
Exactly.
Counsel, can I ask, if you would have tried this case instead of entered into the stipulation, what would the jury verdict look like? What would the jury be deciding?
I think it would have been a standard Judge Decker-type special verdict, negligence on each of the parties, a comparison of negligence, and there would have been a question, did the parties engage in a common scheme or plan?
Okay. And if you got to that 1740 jury instruction, did, and then name defendants, engage in concerted action and then describe alleged action,
right.
What's the concerted action?
The concerted action was the purchase of beer. It was activity by three different individuals. One person knew the adult and convinced the adult to buy the beer. The other threw in the money. He provided the transportation to get to buy the beer, to get to the place where they could drink it. These were underage people. They weren't going to drink it at home. They needed a car. The other actually did the purchase. So those three activities, each was necessary. That was the common scheme or plan.
Okay. So did the defendants engage in concerted action to purchase alcoholic beverages?
Right. Yes.
Okay. So that's the common plan or scheme, purchasing alcoholic beverages?
Right. It is. And I think the Court of Appeals had some problem with this being not an immediate cause. They wanted the common scheme or plan to be driving while intoxicated. Well, if you take that to its logical conclusion, the activity that caused the harm wasn't the drunk driving. The most immediate thing was blowing a stop sign at a high rate of speed and ramming into the plaintiff's car. And to interpret this statute to require that kind of common scheme or plan, that they're going to run into the plaintiff, that's absurd.
Counselor, what if you have three guys, and instead of Zimmerle being 19, he's 22, but he's got no money, and Shrimp is also of age, but he has some money, and but he doesn't have a driver's license or anything to show how old he is, and he knows you always get carded, so he gets his buddy Pritchett to go with them, who's also of age, to buy some alcohol. And so there's the same amount of beer bought, and Pritchett hits the road, and the other two guys go to some party. They drink it all, and Zimmerle hits somebody because he's drunk while he's driving. Now, they have a common plan or scheme to buy alcohol, and you end up with someone that's either dead or severely injured because of drunk driving. Does that fit under the statute?
It would not. And unfortunately, 125, the dram shop liability, would not apply to an adult. So if Zimmerle was an adult and somebody bought him beer, there's no liability on the procurer.
All right. So you have to have minors in order to fit with alcohol being a part of the common scheme or plan.
That's correct.
You don't have any liability on those other people, so they don't even come into play.
Right. They would not be asked. There wouldn't be a question for them on the verdict.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Counsel, in Mr. Friedman's brief, in the appendix, there is a memo from the State Bar of Wisconsin.
Right.
Do you know anything about this memo?
No, I thought it had some reference that it was written by somebody that had Legislative Reference Bureau credentials, I guess. But I didn't see the memo as really affecting this case at all. Yes, I do see it, Your Honor, and there's no author on it. I wasn't thinking of the one that you were referring to. Did Your Honor have some question on that particular document?
Well, I'd like to know where it came from. That's all. The title Concerted Action of Subsection 2. There is a certain gloss being put on that by some of the litigants here. Do you have any documentation to show that their analysis is not really not founded in the legislative history?
There isn't very much legislative history on this one way or the other that's going to address that question. Nothing to help interpret whether this should be applied here. The rules, I think, the statutory interpretation rules that should be applied here. Those words, engaging in a common scheme or plan, are plain. They're clear. And under the plain meaning rule, you just apply the words that the legislature chose. And there's also, I mean, this is in the statutes as well. You don't look to the title to create an ambiguity. That violates the legislative interpretation rules. You don't look to the title. And that's the only way they can get to the concerted action area, if they look to the title. Now, I understand that afterward, after you determine something is plain, you can go back and take a look and see whether your interpretation was correct. I understand that's an accepted principle. And I would suggest that going back to the cases on joint and several liability, the original development of those cases as set forth in Matthies, that would confirm that the legislature indeed did intend to exempt from this statute cases where parties are acting together, where they're acting in a common scheme or plan. That's the explanation for what is going on here.
I just want to follow up on Justice Ziegler's question. So the special verdict, if it had gone to a special verdict, would read, was Shrimp negligent with regard to providing alcoholic beverages, something like that? Was it causal? Was Pratchett negligent with regard to providing alcoholic beverages to a minor?
Right.
Was it causal? And what does Zimmerle's question say? Is it one of those split ones? Is Zimmerle negligent with respect to A, drinking? How does that work?
I wouldn't envision that type of inquiry to the jury on individual respects and negligence. I think that would be, there'd be one question for his negligent. Was he negligent with regard to procuring or driving the vehicle? And the parties would argue that he had a larger share of the blame here, and he should get assigned more negligence because he was in two respects to blame for this.
Suppose the So you're saying that with regard to Zimmerle and with regard to Pratchett, I'm by and large correct in how the question regarding negligence would be worded in the causation. And with regard, I'm Shrimp and Pratchett, with regard to Zimmerle, then it would be worded, you know, it wasn't worded, but what do you think it would say?
With regard to Zimmerle, it might just say, was he negligent with regard to the accident in question? You know, these might have been answered as a matter of law as well. I mean, he ran through a stop sign at a high rate of speed, purchasing alcohol or assisting procuring alcohol. That's negligence per se. I don't know that we ever.
Then you have the standard comparison question, and here we've got the 72 and the 14 and 14. Then you have concerted action question. Then you have the damages question, I suppose.
Right.
Okay. Why even bother with the percentages if it's concerted action and they're all going to be jointly or severally responsible so long as you have that question answered? End of the analysis, isn't it?
Pretty much. It might be for contribution purposes. In this case, we had a Perringer. We would have had to ask that because we settled out that percentage. Mm-hmm. So in this case, we would have needed that.
If you should lose this case, and it has to be the way the Court of Appeals said on concerted, I'd suggest if you had a similar case and tried it again, you better separate it out so that on Zimmerle to see which part of his, what parts of his negligence are.
Yes, I believe that's correct. Yeah, we
have to do that.
Well, that was part of my question.
That's why I think
you
the
weren't,
justices.
But you weren't, you seemed to respond, no, just kind of a standard negligence question on Zimmerle. Would be okay as opposed to sub A with regard to, you know, alcohol, sub B
right.
with regard to, you know,
it, in retrospect, that probably would be the advisable way. My knee-jerk reaction is to avoid, you know, asking the jury a lot of questions because that's where things get messed up. But
you want to go on record.
Well, if a jury came back in this case with a different percentage for Shrimp and Pratchett, would there be sufficient evidence to uphold that kind of verdict?
If Shrimp came back with different negligence than Pratchett, yeah, sure. I would think so because, you know, the argument could be she's an adult, she ought to know better, and the other two were juvenile, so maybe she'd bear a larger share of the blame. I think a jury could find that, yes.
Then would you fit under the Court of Appeals decision? Assuming
that stands, no, we'd lose for a couple of different reasons.
It has to be absolutely equal.
Right. I think that's what the Court of Appeals held, and that isn't a requirement to the statute, that equal liability. Those words aren't used.
Was it required for concerted action under the restatement?
Is it a requirement for concerted action? First of all, this court has never adopted concerted action by name. They applied it once in an old drag racing cases, but the two cases that have touched on it, they were dicta. It wasn't adopted. So we don't know for sure what this court would do as far as equal liability. The restatement, by the way, doesn't specify equal liability. If you look at that, it just...
That's what I'm asking you. Just they act together, so...
They're liable. See, this concerted action is really a theory of liability, as discussed in Collins, as discussed in Brudig. It's a method of holding someone responsible that wouldn't otherwise be liable. Like in the drag racing cases, you had two drag racers. One had a major impact with an innocent third party. The other a minor. The minor one said, "You can't hold me liable. I didn't cause this death." Well, it was the concerted action theory, as it was later called, that's what imposed liability on that individual. So it's a method of imposing liability. It's not a manner of apportioning damages or applying joint and several liability. You're dealing with apples and oranges.
Could I ask you the statutory phrase, in accordance with a common scheme or plan, do you know if that appears in the statutes anywhere else prior to 1995?
I don't believe so. I've researched this term ad nauseum, and I think I would have remembered that if it appeared somewhere else in the statutes.
If the Court of Appeals' interpretation of those words and concerted action as well are correct, does that necessarily mean that you lose?
If the Court of Appeals' opinion stands as written, yes, we would.
Well, I mean, if it stands as written, I mean, they have a certain interpretation of those words, but as I looked at some of those cases, I didn't necessarily come to the same conclusion that they came to.
I'm not so sure that the Court of Appeals really addressed the meaning of those words that Your Honor is referring to, the common scheme or plan. They focused more on the heading to the statute, and they looked to these other cases to define it, which in my opinion is the tail wagging the dog. They're looking to the title to control the statute.
Well, the drafting file talks, this memo acts in concert, I believe it is. In concert is there, and then there's common scheme or plan. I mean, somebody must have had some idea what that. Somebody must have intended it. I mean, if civil trial counsel drafted it, I suspect it would be different if some more neutral person drafted it.
My thought is that they have to call it something. What are they going to call it? It's a descriptive term. Concerted action. It means what? It means common scheme or plan.
Counselor, could I ask you one more question before you get off, because the other side may want to respond.
Ms. Robinson?
Just say we have the same three people. The ages are the same as they are. But the two guys, Shrimp and Zimmerly, decide they don't want to drink the beer, and they take it to one of the guys' houses and stick it in the fridge. And the guys... sister, who's also a minor, a couple of days later said, I see all that beer in the refrigerator. Mom's coming home. You're really going to get in trouble. Could I have it to take with my friends? So Zimmerly gives it to his sister. And she does the driving, and she does the accident, and the result for your client is unfortunately the same. Are we still having a concerted action now with four people? Or is far enough away in time, does that make a difference on how the statute will be applied?
I think, first of all, that individual, the sister, would have to be a minor.
Yeah, I assume she's a minor.
Okay. On the causation part of it, they may have some difficulty proving that up. And, you know, as it gets further down the road, is it 3 months, is it a year? I think that gets more difficult, and that becomes tougher for the jury to answer yes on that question. And, you know, if it gets to the point where it is too far away, a trial court or a court of appeals can apply the public policy factors that we use all the time in causation issues.
Well, this person would not even have been known to the other two people that were involved in procuring here. Does that make a difference, even though she's a minor?
Under our normal rules of causation, I don't think so. Foreseeability isn't a part of cause. Okay, so I don't think... under the legal definitions, it would make a difference, but the jury might view that differently, and the courts could apply their policy factors.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Have an independent act in there that cuts that causation. I mean, that's standard tort law, whether or not the sister's independent act or the brother's independent act of moving that beer to a third party may raise very different issues.
Thank you,
Counsel. You have 5 minutes in a rebuttal. Before we proceed, I would like to introduce special guests that we have today. We have Chief Judge Eugene Whitefish, Potawatomi Tribal Court. Would you introduce your judge with you, please? Well, both of you, welcome. Thank you for coming. Eric Darling, Attorney Darling, representing Badger Mutual Insurance Company.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning, Justices. It is my pleasure to appear before you today representing the defendant, David Schrimpf, as well as his insurance company, Badger Mutual Insurance Company. The most important thing about this case, from my perspective, is that we not lose sight of the fact that what we are gauging here in here is statutory application and, to an extent, statutory interpretation. And in that regard, the single most important thing that I hope we not lose sight of is that if the concerted action slash common scheme or plan liability addressed by subsection 2 of 895.045 is the same concerted action slash common scheme or plan liability addressed by the Wisconsin cases which predate that statute, then the plaintiff's appeal must necessarily fail. The cases, while certainly not extensive and while certainly not discussing every issue that we might address here this morning, make it pretty clear what common scheme or plan slash concerted liability action is really about. And one of the hallmarks of it, obviously, is equal liability. Equal liability not just for the acts that make up the alleged common scheme or plan, but equal liability for the ultimate harm that is the subject of the litigation in the first place. By definition, we do not have anything close to equal liability for the harm that caused the harm that's the subject of this lawsuit. The reason
like
for
my
that,
theory.
I'm not in love with your theory, although I
we don't need love, we just need like.
I must admit that the notion of how one might try to carve up Zimmerli's negligence as between that that was associated with his becoming intoxicated, getting behind the wheel of the car, and not to lose sight of some of the most important aspects of this case, driving like a maniac so as to run a stop sign and T-bone another car.
Let's just suppose instead of Zimmerli, the driver, you have three people who are going to go. You've got one adult, two minors. They're going to procure alcohol, beverage, and all three of them know that there are going to be other minors who are going to drink it. They may even know they have in mind the driver of this car.
It probably happened in this case, by the way, but we don't need to
They all knew that he was going to be one of the drinkers. Now, do you have a concerted action among these three in procuring the alcoholic beverage?
Do you have concerted action as defined by the law? I certainly do not think so. No.
Why not?
You have a common plan in the everyday sense of the word in that the three people went to the store and said, let's buy some beer for this purpose. And by the way, to address the question of what the jury verdict in this case would have said, it had been decided in pretrial proceedings that that was pretty much exactly what it was going to say. Did these three people engage in a common plan to buy beer? I like to think of myself as an effective advocate, but there wasn't going to be much of a way I was going to get the jury to answer that question, no. Which makes the point that this really is a legal issue before us and not review of a factual finding. The judge had made it clear that once they answered that question, yes, she was going to interpret this statute just as the plaintiffs feel that it should be interpreted, and it really wasn't going to matter then, assuming we had a negligence-free plaintiff, what number got assigned to Zimmerli, what number got assigned to Pratchett, and what number got assigned to Schrimpf. The two numbers that hadn't been discharged by the Peringer release were going to be held jointly and severally liable in her view. But to get back to your question, even though the three who bought the beer in your hypothetical are all the only ones involved in the common plan, we've now got other minors at this party that you've hypothesized who the three know are knowingly going to consume beer, and perhaps the minor who's going to consume the beer already knew that those three were going to bring the beer to the party, and maybe that creates a larger common plan that would encompass
none
the smaller
of them are parties. None of them are parties. Just the three that got the liquor, the beer, and the one that drove. Those are your parties in my hypothetical.
even though somebody other than those three consumes the beer and does the negligent driving, ultimately.
The negligent driver did consume the beer.
And
the other parties are not. They were also drinkers at this party, but they're not in this case. They're not defendants.
They are not. The three in question in your hypothetical are not concerted actors as the law defines that term.
Why not?
Because
two or more parties act in accordance with a common scheme or plan. Those parties are jointly and severally liable for all damages resulting from that action.
I realize that's what the statute says, but I don't believe that in referring to the concerted action concept in passing that statute, they intended it to apply to situations such as this, to situations that fall far outside of what has always historically been defined as concerted action. Concerted action is a different breed of cat.
I want you to tell me what breed of cat it is. That's
what bothers me. I don't mean to argue that it's limited to drag racing, but that seems to be sort of the prototypical example. There are other examples. I mean, I think a case that was cited in, I believe, the plaintiff's reply brief probably gives you another good example. Four 16-year-old kids decide to break into a church or a building of some sort and commit all kinds of vandalism. One of them's breaking windows, another one's smashing furniture, a third one's splashing paint all over the place, and a fourth one is lighting candles or setting things on fire. The ultimate big-time damage that is done in that situation results from the fire, and presumably in the eyes of the law, that's going to be deemed concerted action. Those actors are not going to be allowed to defend themselves on, well, hey, I was just throwing paint around, and that couldn't have caused more than $3,000 worth of damage. I shouldn't be held liable for anything else. Or, hey, I was just breaking windows. I should only be 10%.
Counsel, the jury have to do them equal, find equal.
The jury has to decide whether they are concerted actors.
Okay. And I could say they're concerted actors, but I think that the guy that stood at the door watching might be less, have less comparative negligence than the guy that threw the match.
A theory of the case that pursues that fact situation as concerted action would preclude either side arguing that the guy who watches the door is only 5 or 10% liable, whereas the guy who wields the match is 60 or 70% liable.
Counsel, let me ask you this. If you had those, say they're underage, and they engage in that vandalism, but an adult procured alcohol for them, and then after they drank it, they went and engaged in that vandalism. Is the adult responsible for the vandalism?
I don't believe that the adult is liable for the vandalism as a concerted actor, which is probably the relevant inquiry on this particular appeal. There could conceivably be a causation argument that would be made that because the adult procured alcohol and because the alcohol presumably led to the intoxication that induced the decision to go engage in that activity.
So there's a foreseeability requirement, or if it's a separate volitional act, what's the question a jury should answer on that, if anything?
Well, I mean, and it's not just going to be a jury question. I think there's going to be, in your example, there's probably going to be some significant pretrial activity that's going to have to determine whether or not the jury should even be allowed to consider the adult beer provider in your example as a concerted actor. I don't believe the historical case law would support the notion that that guy is a concerted actor.
Why not?
Hey, I asked that question.
I was just being an echo.
Because it deals with the enterprise, if you will, that he's considered to be a part of when engaging in the alleged concerted action, the alleged common plan or scheme, has to be the enterprise that is the immediate cause of the harm. At least that's the Court of Appeals view.
What about this equal liability? I thought that might be your response.
No? Well, I think that's part of it, too. I mean, it's hard to envision a situation where you would say, and let's attenuate it even more. Let's assume that the adult in question who knowingly bought beer for one of these four minors did so 2 or 3 weeks before it happened.
He does it knowing he's not supposed to buy beer for minors. He does it knowing that the minor that he happens to be buying it for is likely to drink it sooner or later. He does it knowing that once that minor drinks that beer, he's likely to engage in somewhat more antisocial behavior than he might sober. But he's certainly not a concerted actor with respect to a subsequent decision to go out and commit some vandalism at a church or whatever our hypothetical is. And I think that's where the analogy breaks down.
Yeah, to me, you're looking at two different things. You're looking at what I oftentimes call the lens, the scope, you know, what's going to be the focus of this concerted action. Are we going to make it very narrow? Are we going to make it a little broader? And depending on how you define the focus, you can get a different result. That's one thing. The other thing is this, you have to be equally liable. Now, I look at the language of the statute. The statute says, if two or more parties act in accord with the common scheme or plan, those parties are jointly and severally liable. So what does it mean that if two or more parties act in accord with a common scheme or plan, does it mean they have to have equal culpability? I look at the other places in the statute where you have somewhat similar language. Any two or more persons who shall combine or concert together for the purpose of willfully or maliciously injuring another in her or reputation. That's 134.01. Now, when you get to that, under 134.01, you don't say, oh, you have to be equally culpable. So why should, you can be a little bit culpable and you get nabbed for a 134.01 violation. The same thing with the standard 930-931 conspiracy. You know, when two or more are gathered in order to commit a conspiracy, in all sorts of criminal cases, you don't need to say they're equally culpable. So when you're focusing on the language in this particular statute, why does acting in when two or more, I'm paraphrasing, are gathered with a common scheme or plan, acting in concert, why does that to be interpreted equal liability and something like 134.01 when two or more are gathered in concert, as the statute says, you don't need equal culpability. So why should I interpret one way and the other way?
Well, to answer it in a way that allows me to avoid addressing Chapter 134, because I haven't prepared to do so, my simple answer is because the cases say it does, because the common law says that it does.
Now, this is a
134
statute.
does not deal with concerted action as defined by the common law, including Wisconsin cases. I do not believe 939 deals with it either. They deal more with civil conspiracy and that sort of things and how actors can be found. Different percentages of negligence in that context is something I'm not really in a position to address.
Well, you are in a position to address this, though. Why should we have the common law with this new statute?
Because I think that's what the legislature had in mind. I don't think we can assume that the legislature did not have concerted action as traditionally defined in mind, and as defined in the Wisconsin case law.
But why not have them defined as they do in 930-931 or whatever the statute is, 930-931 or 134.01? Why didn't they have that in mind? Why is the prior case law more in mind when they're coming up with a new statutory scheme than other statutes?
Well, I don't believe it's a new statutory scheme. When you think about what was going on in 1995 otherwise, we were going from a situation where, assume a negligence-free plaintiff because it makes the discussion easier. We were going from a situation where if one defendant was 20 and the other defendant was 80, but the 20 happened to have deep pockets. In the old days, it didn't matter. The negligence-free plaintiff could still get 100% of his or her damages from the 20 percenter. 1995 changed all of that. That was a legislative decision that we can quarrel with or not on a public policy basis, but that's not what we're here to do today. In 1995, they changed things. The 20-percenter, deep pockets or not, could only be held for 20% of the responsibility. But we kind of had this wild hair out there. Concerted action liability. Brudig, among other cases, discusses concerted action liability. Brudig says you can't have it both ways. You can't have a case where one defendant's 20 and another defendant's 50 and another defendant's 30 and at the same time call it concerted action. Concerted action deals with equal liability. Well, it wouldn't take long for a creative defense lawyer who's otherwise representing somebody who's part of a concerted action and is therefore being held equally liable with, say, one other tortfeasor to say, aha, I've got a guy who's only 50% then, because he's equally liable with the one other guy who's the other 50%, and 50 being less than 51 means I only have to pay 50%. The legislature didn't want that to happen in, for example, a drag racing case, or, for example, a teenage vandalism property damage case. They wanted joint and several liability as it used to work to continue to apply to that limited situation. To say that we wanted to expand that to all kinds of situations where it never applied before and say, well, this behavior that happened early in the causal change can, in some sense of the word, be described as a common plan to go buy beer, a common plan to design or build a building that turns out to have been designed and built negligently, but only after the owner and or the occupier commits additional steps of significant negligence weeks or months later does a frequenter injure themselves. I use the example of a negligent entrustment case in my brief. You could certainly characterize in a 30-year-old man gives a 13-year-old kid the keys to his car. The man knows the kid shouldn't drive. The kid knows the kid shouldn't drive. But the kid nonetheless drives and then does so negligently. Our case law talks about the fact that what happened before doesn't matter until and unless these significant additional acts of individualized negligence happen thereafter. That's the only time the case becomes relevant. Now, in the everyday sense, you could call the act of entrustment a common plan to put a kid behind the wheel of a car, but I don't think our case law, our common law, recognizes the notion that we're going to hold those two equally liable rather than finding the entrustor whatever percentage we choose to find the entrustor and conversely the driver whatever percentage we find him. We individualize that negligence, and under those circumstances, subsection 1 applies. I believe that's the proper interpretation of this law. I feel that that's the properly constrained interpretation of this law. And to take a case where 72% has been stipulated to be the negligence of the party from whom a significant settlement has already been obtained, and then come back and say, but even though this one's only 14, and even though this one's only 14, and even though theirs is something less than one-fifth of what the third person involved in the common scheme or plan was, that's still concerted action. This is a concerted action statute. We can't turn our eyes to the fact that that's what the title to the statute says. You can't use a title to create doubt where doubt otherwise exists, but you certainly can use the title to a statute to confirm that which the substance of the statute is probably telling you already.
Counsel, what about, I just want to get your position on the fact that we're dealing with a statute that deals with apportionment of liability after negligence has already been found. How does that impact?
Well, I think what I say in my brief is that subsection 1 clearly does deal with apportionment. In my view, and I think the Brudig case supports this, Prosser supports this, in my view, subsection 2 exists because there is this species of liability in which apportionment is not to be engaged in.
The reason I ask the question is, once again, the plain language of the statute, as I understand it, deals with notwithstanding subsection 1, then it goes into subsection 2. It still seems to be in the, am I missing something? It still seems to be in the apportionment provision that you can't even get to this statute. You can't get to sub 1 or sub 2 unless negligence has already been found.
Negligence has to have been found, but apportionment is an additional step in the process of finding negligence.
So why isn't sub 2 a species of the apportionment that's referred to in sub 2 when it refers to sub 1?
I think the purpose of sub 2, in my view, is to prevent an argument that equal liability amounts to apportionment of 50-50 in the case of two actors, or 33 1/3, 33 1/3, 33 1/3 in the case of three actors. Because the case law says, no, we're not even apportioning there. We're not attaching percentages to these people. They're all jointly and severally liable. That's my view of what subsection 2 is about.
I'm trying to think of a case that you would accept as concerted action, maybe a drag race around the Capitol Square.
Okay.
At the same time, you have another driver who's not part of the drag race driving. But because of the drag race, this driver also does something negligent, and somebody is injured. And the jury comes back and finds that the drag racers have been causally negligent, as well as this third-party driver, okay? And let's say it's 72-14-14.
72 on...
On the driver of the car that hits.
On the one not involved in the drag race.
Right. Hits the pedestrian. So you got concerted action at 14 and 14. Would that fit the statute?
Well,
same exact.
This gets back to your theory that I said I wasn't in
love
with.
No, but now I'm putting in drag racing.
Right.
Would you accept as concerted action? So, you might not love my theory, but I now got into your theory.
My view is that you wouldn't be getting to the 14 and 14 on the two drag racers. Because if somebody wants to treat them as concerted actors, they are really holding the activity liable. Now, that raises the tangential question of, well, then are we going to say, okay, what percentage do you attach to the drag race and what percentage do you attach to the third party who was not involved in the drag race but nonetheless negligent?
Right.
And I don't know the answer to that question. My guess is you might have to do that. But the key point there, in my view, is that as between the two drag racers, we're not going to be saying 14 and 14 or 16 and 12 or 15 and 13. We're going to be saying the drag race is a concerted action and all parties involved in the drag race are jointly and severally liable for all damages for which that activity is liable.
Yeah, but how do you divide out the death of the pedestrian?
How do you divide it?
How can you say that the drag racing caused...
Well, in your example, you kind of just did it. You did 28% on the drag race and 72% on the third party driver, the third driver who wasn't racing but apparently was doing something else quite negligent. But I don't think you need to subdivide out the 28. I just don't think the law provides for that. Concerted action, as I said before, is a different breed of cat.
So it wouldn't apply in my new hypothetical.
I'm not saying that the drag race wouldn't be concerted action. And I've got some questions about how it would percolate out with this other negligence committed by a non-drag racing tortfeasor. But I'm saying that the concerted actors are not to have individualized percentages attached to them. We've got individualized percentages attached here, and we do not have concerted actors for that reason and for a number of other reasons, the others having to do with the fact that the act in question isn't the immediate cause of the harm either. That's obviously the point that the Court of Appeals...
I think we have a problem where you have concerted... We have a common scheme for some of the tortfeasors, but not others, and they all cause an indivisible damage.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
That's what I think the issue is.
There is obviously some issues that would have to be worked through, but I think there are any number of fact scenarios where a concerted action could combine with other negligence,
yes,
not part of that concerted action.
That's what I'm trying to get to.
And you'd
to
still
you.
Be able to work through
to
it.
Cause one injury.
To ultimately cause one injury,
right.
Sure.
And that's,
I mean, you could have two or more parties design a building, pursuant to a plan to design a building. Much more negligence intervenes. An accident happens weeks or months down the road. There's still causation there. But to call that concerted action in the well, we're not going to get into individualized percentages, I don't think is what the law
will allow. Then what you're saying is that subsection 2 just can't apply in the fact situation. We have concerted action and another negligence.
I think it could conceivably apply to the manner in which the concerted actors are being held liable for that concerted action and the degree to which it ultimately contributes to the harm. But I also don't think we can assume that what we're talking about here is 14 plus 14 plus 14 plus 58. That certainly wasn't stipulated to, and this case shouldn't have a different outcome if Shrimp's 12 and Pratchett's 16. I don't believe that.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Is buying that...
Justice Prosser.
Is buying that booze a tortious act?
In the view of Chapter 125, it is. Now, it's not a tortious act if they're all adults. If they're all adults, we're not here today, regardless of any other factors you might inject about knowledge of Zimmerli's problem with drinking and driving and everything else. There's statutory dram shop protection. But one of the parts of Chapter 125 exempts from dram shop protection those who procure for a minor. Shrimp was a procurer. I had to stipulate that because he was involved in the process of introducing Ms. Pratchett to the situation.
Negligence per se under the statute?
Is
the procurement?
Is procurement negligence per se? I'm not prepared to answer that question.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Weber, representing the Amicus Civil Trial Council of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Justice. Ralph Weber and Beth Hannon are pleased to be here on behalf of Civil Trial. Thank you for allowing us to participate. I think Mr. Darling's analysis is spot on, and it has the additional benefit of simplicity. And let me just try coming at it from a different perspective. I think this court's decision and concurring opinion in Kalal provide the framework to answer this case. And in Kalal, the concurring Chief Justice wrote that what we're trying to accomplish here is an exercise in logic in which a court determines what a reasonable person in the position of a legislator enacting the statute would have said about the legal issue presented in a given case. And here we have a legislature or legislator who is wrestling with the issue of under what circumstances do we transfer the assets of person A to answer for the fault of person B? Of course, that's what joint and several liability does. I'm taking additional money out of your pocket above and beyond what you're legally what you're factually responsible for, because as a matter of law, we're going to have you account for somebody else. And in 95, the legislature said, you know what, we're going to cut back on that. And we're going to make it more rare to require someone to pay for somebody else's factual fault. And they used the 51% threshold to create that simplicity. Now, they didn't stop there. And I think, as counsel said, what the legislature did in the next paragraph, they said was, but we're not going to allow this shield to be used by people in concerted action. That three people in a drag race can't come in and say, nope, you can't get my assets because this is concerted action, and therefore I'm only 33 and a third. Or two people, we're 50-50. Legislature said, you know, in that unusual case, we're not going to allow those defendants the benefit of the protections that we're providing under paragraph A. And so in that unusual case where you don't do apportionment, the defendants can't avoid transfer of assets by embracing the shield of concerted action.
But as a reasonable legislator, say we have both concerted action and an independent, negligent person.
Right. Your two drag racers around the square.
Then we don't have to worry. Right.
Yep. I think, again, Mr. Darling was correct. I think that in that instance, you would have a verdict with 28% for the two and 72% for the third. And then we're getting into, I mean, it's reminiscent of crashworthiness cases, enhanced injury cases, which is, if I may, somewhat appropriate in that Mr. Murphy, who sadly can't be here today, was one of the creators of that genesis of the common law. But here, of course, the legislator is cutting back on the common law. The legislature is saying, we don't think it's right to transfer assets in all circumstances. We're going to change the common law. And I think the legislature, as a co-equal branch, is entitled to do that. They've done it the other way.
What's the answer to
the drag racing is, I think, off the top of my head, there would be some form of special verdict that would require an allocation by the jury between the concerted action and the independent act.
Okay, so what about the 28-72?
Right, the 28-72. I think you would say, as to the 28%, that those people don't get the benefit of subsection A 51% rule because they're concerted actors.
So they would, in other words, then they'd have to pay for each other.
And I think everything, if in fact there is a, if they are liable for causing the injury.
So not
they don't
only
get the they don't get the benefit of the 51% rule.
So in your interpretation, not only for potentially all of the 28%, but in addition, the additional 72%. That's what is. Do I hear?
Yeah,
you
that's correct? Right. I think depending, I mean, we'd have to actually compare this against what the court has done in enhanced injury cases, and there is always that tension between wanting to get money to the injured party, and then on the other hand saying, yeah, but sometimes too much is too much. As the Chief said in response to Justice Rogensack's scenario about, well, then there's another person who gets the alcohol, and the Chief said, well, yes, but at some point there's an independent act that cuts causation. And so under the common law, at some point you say too much is too much.
But here where you had the Perringer release, they wouldn't be liable for the 72, but each of the ones for 14 would be liable for the other.
Right. I think it's...
if there were concerted action.
Yep. I think what counsel's saying is, and is correct, is that having provided a protection with the 51% rule, there was a certain subset of cases that they didn't want to, to whom they did not want to extend that protection.
And your position here, then, is Badger Mutual wins, doesn't have to pay the extra 14% because you don't view this as concerted action.
Exactly right.
Okay.
Yep,
why I switched to the drag race.
Absolutely. Because I think the plaintiff has a tactical choice to make. Okay. Am I going to try this as a concerted action case and not attempt to have apportionment, or do I want to have apportionment?
You'd have a hard time doing a concerted action with a third person independent of the drag race.
Yes,
so you've got to have both concerted action and the independent.
Right, which I think and then informs this court's analysis of what would a reasonable legislator want to do. And I don't think the legislator, if you asked these scenarios, would say, I want to make this really complicated. I want to have multiple special verdicts akin to enhanced injury and other permutations. I think they had a simple idea in mind and viewed through that lens of we're simply taking away the 51% protection to, in unusual cases, the statute is best understood.
Chief, if I may.
Yeah, Justice Bradley.
Just one final question. Do you think the language of the statute in issue 895.045 sub 2 is clear and unambiguous?
I think as the court has talked about that in the context of Kalal, I would say yes, that looking at the purpose and the context, it is, which you're permitted to do under Kalal, it is not ambiguous. But I still think it's important to look at all the things Kalal talks about.
Well, I took with note both your brief and your opening statement didn't cite the majority opinion. You cited the
concurring opinion, and there's a difference, and the difference is at least one of the differences, probably lots of differences, but one of the differences is the framework essentially, paraphrasing, what would a reasonable legislator be doing with this language? And you look at that, potentially the majority would say, hey, you look at the language, and if it's clear and unambiguous, you don't go to the legislative history.
Well, yes, but you still look at the context and the purpose. And I know there was that debate about whether history gets included or not.
That's
and
right.
The
very
and
good.
The footnote that you the majority at, wrote that maybe called into question how much unanimity there was in your decision. But I think if we step back and look at context, which I think everybody agrees.
That's fine, context.
The context is under what circumstances do we transfer assets? And that ties into your question about 13401. Why under 13401 is it appropriate to transfer assets from one another? Well, because that's willful and malicious conduct. That's an intentional tort. And so the legislature says where you have those kinds of actors that meet the requirements of 13401, then we're not going to worry about apportionment either. They don't get the benefit of the 51% rule either because they're acting willfully and maliciously.
Chief, if I may.
Justice Butler.
I want to follow up Justice Bradley's question and your answer to her question about the statute and whether or not it's clear and unambiguous. And you answered that you thought it was clear and unambiguous. And I go right to the holding in paragraph 25 of the Court of Appeals opinion. We therefore hold that in order for concerted action liability to attach under the statute, the persons held liable must have acted in accordance with, quote, a common scheme or plan to accomplish the result that injures the plaintiff, end quote. I look at the language of the statute that says if two or more parties act in accordance with a common scheme or plan, those parties are jointly and severally held liable for all damages resulting from that action. They're two different things. One is a result. The statute talks in terms of a result based on an act involving a common scheme or plan. The analysis of the Court of Appeals talks in terms of causation. Now, I understand how the Court of Appeals got to where it got. They've explained it. But you certainly can't get that from the statute.
Well, again, with all respect, I think looking at the things you're permitted to look at under Kalal and unambiguous statute, you do get there. And I think the problem is if you look at this through the lens of the substantial factor test, then it's for want of a nail, a kingdom is lost sort of jurisprudence. And would a reasonable legislator say, when we adopt this simple bright line statute with a clear and simple 51% threshold, do we simultaneously want to create incredible complexity in the trial courts with special verdicts that will have multiple parts because what we're really adopting is a carve-out of for want of a nail, a kingdom is lost. That doesn't seem what a reasonable legislator would do.
Counsel, I understand your point. The reason I asked the question is because much of your answer, if not all of your answer, is based on information that's extraneous to the language of the statute. And so when we're talking about plain and unambiguous in a Kalal-type approach and looking at the plain meaning of the statute, and like I say, I understand how the Court of Appeals got to where it got. I mean, they've certainly laid it out. But it seems that they're basing their decision on things that are outside of the plain language of the statute, based on the history of the concerted action rule, based on what the legislature may have intended. I mean, there are a lot of things that they've looked at, but it's not just the language.
Well, but it is, as the concurring opinion in Kalal says, an exercise in logic. And so as we're talking about these things, logic compels us to say, what is the consequence of viewing it this way? And would a legislature, having created a bright line rule, simultaneously created such a complex and convoluted statute? And in addition, remember, we're 12 years down the road. If it's so clear and simple the other way, Why is it only 12 years later that Waddell is coming forward and saying, aha, sub 2 really is an enormous carve-out from A, or B from A, as opposed to where we are, which is practitioners have lived with this view espoused by Mr. Darling for 12 years. It's only now that a very creative plaintiff's counsel has said, hey, wait a minute. Maybe we can get around that legislative judgment from 1995 by arguing a different view of this statute.
I have had a hard time thinking of other common schemes in the tort field. I mean, the intoxicating beverage is a very special kind of statute that imposes a negligence. I've had a hard time thinking of another, other than your drag race kind of example, that would be a common scheme in a negligence case.
Right. Maybe the old Summers versus Tice, you know, the people shooting the two shotguns.
And that's the restatement, too, has right. that. And yep. has people that
and I think
deer hunting kind right. of examples.
And I think your experience informs what we're talking about, that it is a very unusual situation. Not the common. I mean, it's probably the rare tort case with multiple defendants that you couldn't construct an argument to say, oh, there's a common scheme or plan, therefore no 51% rule. And
oh,
12 years' experience
rare?
Where that hasn't happened.
You think it's rare to find a common scheme in a negligence
I think,
case?
No, I'm saying I think if you view common scheme as broadly as Richards would like, the 51% rule will go away in many, many cases. Mm-hmm. I think the fact of what the legislature mm-hmm. was doing was exactly your experience, that it's a very rare case mm-hmm. where we're going to say concerted action, this is concerted action, mm-hmm. and therefore you don't get the benefit mm-hmm. of the 51%.
Justice Prosser,
do you? Mr. Weber, do you know what the source of this memo is?
It's from counsel's brief, and I'm sure he'll be able to inform us now. I don't know.
Okay.
Thank you.
From the State Bar on its heading. All right. Thank you, Mr. Weber. James Friedman, Attorney Friedman, representing the Amicus Wisconsin Insurance Alliance Property Casualty Insurers Association of America. I've now used up your 5 minutes.
Justice, I am James Friedman from Godfrey & Kahn, and as the Chief Justice noted, I represent AMICI, the Wisconsin Insurance Alliance, and Property Casualty Insurers Association of America. And I'd like to thank the Court and Mr. Darling for the opportunity to participate in this argument today. I'd like to make a few points and hopefully not be too repetitive and hopefully also respond to some of the questions and comments of the Court. And Justice Prosser, I'll start with you. The plaintiff in this case is running as fast as she can from the title Concerted Action in Section 895.045 sub 2, and for good reason, because the common law in Wisconsin, because the restatement, because the treatises, including Prosser, under all of those authorities, the plaintiff would lose because the definition of concerted action is much more narrow than she would like. And Justice Prosser, what we have in the back of our brief is, I think, the entire drafting record on the statute. And I'll note that the plaintiff chose not to cite that, even though in two spots, not just the somewhat unintelligible memo from the State Bar that you've pointed out, but also in the LRB analysis, they use the term, quote, concerted action in describing what the point of sub 2 is. This is about concerted action. And the legislature is deemed to know what the common law was when it created the statute. And again, I think the plaintiff loses if this is about concerted action as defined in the common law. Justice Bradley, briefly, because I think Mr. Weber touched on it, your examples of other statutes, I think they're completely inapplicable in this case because they are statutes where intent is part of the statutory scheme. It's intentional torts as opposed to negligence. 895.045 is only about negligence, you know, as is the contributory negligence statute. And so I don't think you can compare, it's comparing apples and oranges essentially, because the rules of joint and several liability and the rules of contributory negligence just don't apply with intentional torts. Chief, I'll try to take on your unique analysis that I don't think any of us had thought of until today, but I think counsel for the plaintiff has acknowledged that Badger Mutual and Mr. Shrimp would win under that analysis, because counsel for the plaintiff has explained that the common law of joint and several liability kind of grew up with two branches. The one branch where there were two divisible, entirely separate acts but an indivisible injury, and then the concerted action type where there's indivisible acts, common scheme or plan, concerted action, and that the legislature dealt with the first type where the actions are divisible or entirely separate but the harm is indivisible in sub one. And that's what we have here. That's how your analysis plays out if you go to the next step, Chief, because there are two separate acts here, totally divisible acts. One is the procurement of the alcohol, and the other is the very negligent drunken driving. And so sub one does apply, and the parties acknowledge that by apportioning liability as sub one suggests you do. So you never get to sub two.
Only because you say so, counsel. You get to sub two if you then divide out these two acts, which are divisible, they're separate, and you say at least as to the parties in the common scheme, or if you prefer the drag race example, concerted, you can divide as to them, they have to share liability. That is, they're liable for each other in toto. But as to the other party, you apply sub one.
Well, I suggest that that's not the way it would play out, because the only way you get to sub two is if there's concert between Mr. Zimmerly's conduct driving and the action of the other defendants.
So in the drag race example I gave you, you would treat that the same way as you treat this case.
And I got lost a little bit in some of the hypotheticals, Your Honor, but if the drag race is a third party bought some beer for the drag race or something like that.
Oh, forget the beer.
I'm sorry, what?
Forget the beer.
Okay. What did the third party do in your hypothetical?
Third party ran a red light and caused the injury, too.
There's certainly no concerted action between that third party's conduct and...
Absolutely. Yep. Absolutely. They're two independent. But
right.
As to the two people drag racing, you have concerted action.
But the action that caused the injury... The action that you're trying to decide whether you can break down is the drunk driving, running the stop sign at speeds in excess of the limit. So there's not concerted action in our situation. I'll also go back, Your Honor, to the main argument that most people have focused on today, which, you know, this isn't concerted action as defined in the common law, as defined by the restatement by Mr. Prosser, et cetera.
Then you don't necessarily agree with Mr. Weber.
I think on that point, I might not. I think under either analysis, whether it's the analysis that Mr. Darling put forth, and which is consistent with our brief and Mr. Weber's brief, under that analysis, there just plain isn't concerted action. That second half is not concerted. But I think also under your analysis, Your Honor, there wouldn't be a second level of division. You look, does one apply or does two apply? And clearly one applies, because those are two very separate acts. And I think that may be kind of the crux of what we've been trying to get at here. Why is it that they're negligent but they're not concerted? There's causation. That's a different analysis entirely.
Number two only applies, in your opinion, if all of the negligent parties were in concert.
Correct.
Chief,
two different doesn't apply.
Right.
Okay.
If I might.
Mr. Butler.
With respect to sub 2 of the statute, and I want to ask this question about the Court of Appeals opinion, for purposes of this question and this question only, should this court disagree with the Court of Appeals regarding the argument regarding equal liability, that that's a prerequisite to concerted action. If we disagree with that approach, in implying the statute that for purposes of liability, does the statute call for a common scheme or plan for any act that's negligent that results in damages, or, as the Court of Appeals had held, must it be a common scheme or plan to accomplish the result that injures the plaintiff?
Your Honor, I'd suggest the Court of Appeals analysis was correct. The Court of Appeals followed the analysis from the common law, which I think is consistent with the treatises out there as well. I think they're right. I'd stick with that analysis. That said, I don't think that the answer is different if you apply the Chief's analysis. Chief, may I end with a hypothetical that I think maybe hits home?
Well, I'd like to ask questions before you
answer, Justice Presser. Then you can use the hypothetical.
There is no other legislative history that you found that the people sponsoring this legislation intended to put the gloss on these words that you claim is there. There's nothing more.
Justice Prosser, we reviewed the entire, all the legislative history available at the Legislative Reference Bureau online, wherever the various places you can find it these days, and found nothing that had any relevance to the question of what was the legislature getting at when it said, use the title concerted action, used the phrase common scheme or plan other than what we've set before you. That may be the entirety of the legislative history, but I can't swear to that. I don't recall. But that's all we could find that had any relevance. And I'll note, there are a bunch of other parties in amici involved, and nobody found anything to the contrary or anything else that was relevant.
Who sponsored this bill?
Joanne Hilsman.
Pardon me?
Joanne Hilsman.
I see who's on it and the number of legislators, but we've got a drafting request by the State Bar, right?
No.
And they must have had a committee on this. And George Brown is one of the people to contact, and John Walsh is the other. So there are other people involved in this.
That's an assembly substitute amendment to Senate Bill 11.
Okay.
But I think the chief makes a point. Was the bill amended in the assembly?
I'm sorry, was the bill amended what?
In the assembly. Or anywhere.
I don't think subsection 2 was changed in the process from when the LRB analyzed it, as they have in, I think, page 5 of our appendix. We didn't see anything suggesting that there were substantive changes to sub 2 subsequent to that analysis.
But the 51% came in somewhere during the process by amendment. Do you know who did that?
I don't off the top of my head, Justice Prosser, sorry.
Give us your hypothetical.
We've set forth hypotheticals which we think show that the plaintiff's interpretation would lead to absurd results. There's another one not in any of the briefs that I think really hits the nail on the head. If we had a fourth party involved in this case, if we had another driver, and this other driver is a minor with a fake ID, used the fake ID to purchase alcohol, drank the alcohol, got behind the wheel of the car, sped, went through a stop sign, and hit Mr. Richards' car from another direction, that other driver would have an entirely divisible, separate situation in which he was causally negligent. And if we'd gone to a jury, and the jury apportioned 20% liability to that driver, that person who violated multiple criminal and civil statutes as well as acting negligently under the common law, that person could only be responsible for 20% of the damages in this case. And yet the plaintiff would like Mr. Shrimp, whose sole negligent act, sole tortious act, was finding someone to buy alcohol for him, had nothing to do with the driving, nothing else, would like to be able to apportion 100% of the liability to Mr. Shrimp. That would be an absurd result. that could occur under the plaintiff's analysis would not, under what I think is a more reasonable analysis set forth by Badger Mutual and Mr. Shrimp in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Friedman. Mr. Stonewick, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think your inquiry moments ago about other fact patterns where this would apply, I'd like to answer that right now. I saw a case argued earlier in this term, probably about 2 months ago. It involved an architect and a builder. This individual acted as both the architect and builder. He specified some poor floor plans, and then he carried it out in a poor manner. Well, that's a good example. If those two individuals, if those two companies would have been operated separately, that's the perfect case for applying the joint and several liability. When these parties are working together to accomplish a result like put up a building and each of them is negligent in some respect, that's a good example of how this statute ought to be applied.
Sub 1 or sub 2, counsel?
Sub 2, because they are engaged in a common scheme or plan to put on an addition. And it fits perfectly with this definition of a common scheme or plan. I want to get back to this title because I think their whole arguments are hinged on this title, the concerted action. And I also thought that I heard concessions that this statute isn't ambiguous. If that indeed is the case, it would be inappropriate to look to the title under case law and the statutes. Unless the court wants to look afterward to confirm its interpretation, and I submit that the words, again, used by Justice Crooks in the Matthies case are appropriate. He said the doctrine of joint and several was initially applied at common law to situations where there was a concert of action, where there was a concert of action or a breach of a joint duty on the part of multiple tortfeasors. Thus, persons who acted in concert or breached a common duty causing injury were considered to be joint tortfeasors, and each could be held jointly and severally liable. Those words are used in the early development of this law of joint and several. That's the explanation for what is going on here. It's that initial class where joint and several started. That's what subsection 2 is dealing with.
Counsel, one of the things that concerns me is that I think sub 2 is special. And you gave us an example at the get-go, the architect and builder. And I think, you know, the water in the basement case or the defective home isn't this very special kind of lawsuit. I think it's a garden variety, and you, as a plaintiff, you sue the person that did the plans, you sue the person that installed it, you sue the person, you know, you bring them all in. It sounds to me you're saying, as long as they're all of those different workers and they have a common scheme or plan to build an addition, then joint and several liability, then the 51% rule is out.
Well, you've got to...
It's out the window of that new addition.
Yes, with the proviso that these parties are negligent, that they are causally negligent in the first instance. And I think that's a plain reading of the statute.
That's an awfully garden variety sort of case. It seems to me, you know, I mean, that causes me a lot of concern.
Well, I think you're accepting this. I think your initial thought that this is a very rare type of application of the law, I think, is based on a false premise that there's nothing in the statute that said that this is to be, narrowly construed or narrowly applied. It's only what they're saying that it is. And them saying so doesn't make it the case. If you look to the development of the common law, these two different categories of joint and several liability where you had independent tortfeasors, if you look to that development, this fits in perfectly with the way this statute is set up. There's two types of joint and several, with the indivisible injury but independent acts of negligence, and you had the situations where they concurred. That fits this statute. The The other thing that I haven't heard is what the word joint and several liability means in this statute. If you take the provision, if you take what they're saying at face value, joint and several, those words would be redundant. They'd be meaningless because we're dealing, according to them, with the equal liability. And that's one thing that this court doesn't want to do. It doesn't, I don't think it wants to take out words or add words like equal, adding equal to that, or taking out the word joint and several, which would be completely meaningless. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank all of the counsel in this case for discussing this joint and several liability issue, which has not come to our court before, and trying to deal with not only the facts of this case, but some hypotheticals that were raised that may or may not have been applicable. So thank you to all of the counsel, and that concludes our hearing in Richards versus Badger Mutual. The court will take a very brief recess so that the students may leave and counsel may leave, and counsel for the next case may come into the courtroom. We are in recess.